The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is underwritten by Highwoods Properties. With its headquarters in Raleigh, North Carolina, Highwoods, a real estate investment trust, is committed to making our communities better places to live and work. Highwoods can be reached at 866-449-6637. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, The Uncertainty Era, from tariff turmoil and price spikes to AI fears, a host of factors are pushing small businesses into tough choices. And this cover story is actually three stories inside the Triangle Business Journal with the separate headlines. The first one, small retail businesses scramble to find space in a tight market. Space is scarce across the triangle as entrepreneurs search for the right fit. And this is written by Kate Tracy. Amid a laundry list of challenges, Triangle small business owners can put the search for real estate right at the top. When Don McLaren decided to bring Godfather's Pizza back to Raleigh, it took him almost a year to find his restaurant space. For Delia Clovecorn, that timeline stretched almost 2 years before she landed on a home for her restaurant, Mech Cocina Mexicana in Cary. Clovecorn said the business, the process was so frustrating she almost decided to just give up and get a food truck. Husband and wife duo Ryan and Claire Young have also experienced this tightness firsthand. They signed their franchise agreement with Magnolia Soap and Bath Company in August 2024, but didn't sign their lease at Quail Corner Shopping Center until the following spring. Claire Young said, it took forever to find the right fit as far as the foot traffic and demographic they wanted. In and around Raleigh and Durham, it makes sense that retailers are struggling to find the right fit for their businesses. After all, the Triangle's overall retail vacancy rate is 2.7%, much lower than the vacancy rate of 4.4% around the country, according to CoStar Group. In Raleigh, that vacancy rate is even slightly lower at 2.6%, up 0.2% from the past year, while Durham's vacancy rate is 2.8%, down 0.3% over the past year, according to CoStar. Jeremy Deckelbaum with real estate firm Elm Partners said that when it comes to helping small business owners find the right space, every situation is different. Some of his clients are starting lease negotiations within a month, while others are spending more than a year to find the right retail space. Being a first-time business owner makes that search all the more challenging. If it's someone's first time and they don't have super strong financials, that makes it even more difficult because not every landlord will approve that, Deckelbaum said. Retail space often gets snatched up before the building is under construction. That was the case with owner Michael Longo with Vic's Pizzeria and Bar in Wendell Falls, as that restaurant won't open until mid-2027. Some parts of town are more competitive than others. North Raleigh has lower vacancy than downtown, although downtown is starting to fill up again with small businesses. North Hills, Village District, and Fenton are all extremely competitive for business owners looking to snag a space. Village District is so competitive that there is a wait list of retailers wanting to lease it. For small business owners who are waiting around for the right deal to come along, Deckelbaum said it's important to trust the process and not force any decisions. You don't want to just have someone take a space to take it, he said. You want to make sure that it's the right space where they're going to be able to succeed, because if not, then you have to help them figure out how to get out of their lease a year after they open, and it involves a very upset landlord and a tenant losing money. Deckelbaum said part of his work involves coaching landlords to work with talented chefs or hospitality leaders to open new spots. If they give money to someone to help them fund a restaurant and it doesn't work out, they're left with a restaurant to lease to someone else, and second-generation restaurants are probably one of the easiest types of commercial real estate to lease, Deckelbaum said. Elm Partners prefers doing deals with local landlords. After all, unlike REITs or REITs or large out-of-state real estate firms, local landlords who are customers at their chefs' restaurants can be more willing to take risks on chefs and hospitality operators because they believe in them. At the same time, we also express to our clients that you've got to have some money or some security behind you, Deckelbaum said. We usually just try to help them figure out the financial situation, whether that's from family and investors or from one of the various local banks in town. And the second article, written by Lauren Onosorge, headline, Triangle farmers hang on as fuel prices soar. Economic anxiety is especially keen for small farms that face unexpected costs. For food producers across the triangle, soaring fuel costs are more than a market fluctuation. They're a direct hit to operating budgets when there is no room to absorb it. Bankers say broader economic anxiety is already weighing on business decision-making. The most immediate impact has clearly been high fuel prices, said John Asbury, CEO of Atlantic Union Bank. This does put a lot of pressure on inflation. That pressure is landing squarely in farm fields as planting season gets underway. Nick Pope's family has owned Pope Farms in Knightdale for decades, dating back to 1954, when his grandfather first bought the land from his wife's family. Spring is the operation's most demanding stretch. Pope spends his days crisscrossing the region, managing about 750 acres spread across multiple sites. On a recent Monday, Pope was headed to a field an hour away, trying not to watch the fuel gauge drop. "When we've got trucks and tractors running all day, you can burn 50 or 100 gallons of fuel easy," he said. "That puts a hit to the wallet." Diesel prices have surged nationwide amid the war with Iran, and disruptions to global energy flows. As of late April, the national average price of diesel was about $5.46 per gallon, according to AAA, up about $1.60 per gallon since the conflict began in late February. For North Carolina, AAA reports diesel prices at or near record highs set in 2022. Unlike manufacturers or logistics firms that can add fuel surcharges, farmers have no such lever. Commodity prices are set by global markets. "Agriculture prices are determined by the markets," Pope said. "We are at their mercy." John Boyd, a fourth-generation farmer and founder of the National Black Farmers Association, said the math behind higher diesel prices is immediate and unforgiving. Boyd is based in Virginia and farms in both Virginia and North Carolina. "My tractor holds 100 gallons of fuel," Boyd said. "Just to fill it up, that's $600, a lot of money for farmers." And that tank, he said, doesn't stretch nearly as far as many people assume. Research from Iowa State University shows row crop farms often burn roughly 3 gallons of diesel per acre just for planting and harvest operations, meaning fuel costs can add hundreds or thousands of dollars in extra expense as prices climb. Boyd said farmers did not budget for fuel at today's prices. While national leaders have called for patience, that advice is difficult to follow on a fixed planting calendar. "It's planting season now," Boyd said. "We have to do something now." Fuel is only part of the squeeze. Boyd said fertilizer costs have surged sharply in recent weeks. Fertilizer prices have risen by 40% over the past month in parts of the Mid-Atlantic, according to grain producer groups, with some farmers seeing increases of $100 to $300 per ton since the war escalated. Boyd said shortages are as concerning as price. "I haven't even been able to get fertilizer," he said. "That's the first part of the process. You have to apply your fertilizer before you can put your corn plants in the ground." Roughly one-third of the world's seaborne fertilizer supply passes through the Strait of Hormuz, which has seen major shipping disruptions since the war began, according to the United Nations. Boyd said farmers feel overlooked amid broader policy debates. While manufacturer supply chains go back and forth across borders, what farmers are producing, corn, beef, soybeans, are harvested as the final product, he said. "We're not making anything in this country anymore, but we're still producing corn, beef, and soybeans. This is really putting farmers in harm's way." He said the strain rivals the farm crisis of the 1980s, with one crucial difference. "Then at least you could get a bag of fertilizer if you needed it," Boyd said. At Pope Farms, the operation employs 4 full-time workers and runs as much on tradition as on balance sheets. Rising costs leave little margin for error. So how is Pope Farms pushing through as uncertainty around the Iran crisis drags on? "Faith," Pope said. It's about all you've got, really. And our third and final segment of this cover story is written by Andy Medici. The private credit squeeze is hitting small businesses. Favorable terms may be hard to come by amid industry upheaval. The cracks spreading through the private credit market are growing larger, and small businesses should pay attention. Big private credit providers have been faced with an outsized demand for withdrawals from spooked investors and have limited those amounts. Blue Owl Capital sold $1.4 billion in assets to meet outflows, while Ares Management capped redemptions at 5% in one fund after redemption requests hit 11.6%. Morgan Stanley said in a recent outlook that direct lending defaults could surge to 8% or higher, well above historical averages between 2 and 2.5%, based in part on the rise of artificial intelligence and the risk that it devalues existing software company investments. The deterioration of the private credit market doesn't impact small business lending directly. The smallest of businesses often use credit cards or personal financing to keep things afloat. Larger small businesses, however, that rely on banks or private equity to close deals may find credit to be harder to come by or more expensive, according to lending experts. That is more true now than it was a decade ago, said Michael Von Bevern, global head of funds at Sunterra Global. As private credit markets have grown and have become more central to the lending ecosystem than they were before, that's also made their impact more visible. Looking toward 2026, small businesses face two realities, Bevern said. Banks are cautious, especially with early stage or under-collateralized borrowers. Private credit funds will continue to fill the gap, underwriting entrepreneurs. However, financing terms may not be as favorable as they were recently. The evidence of a lending squeeze trickling down to smaller businesses has increased. A March report from Fitch Ratings found that the default rate in its portfolio of privately monitored ratings hit 9.2% in 2025, up from 8.1% in 2024. Smaller firms, those with earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization of $25 million or less, showed a 15.8% default rate compared to just 4% for issuers with EBITDA above $100 million. The January 2026 Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices by the Federal Reserve found that lending standards across commercial and industrial loans tightened across all business sizes. The report noted that part of the reason for that is that banks have become less likely to approve loans for firms adversely affected by high AI exposure. All that stress on private credit now has started widening the so-called spread, or the interest rate charged on loans above the prime lending rate set by the Federal Reserve. A survey of private credit participants by PitchBook LCD in fourth quarter 2025 found that only 6% of respondents expected a plain vanilla $50 million EBITDA. Business in a non-cyclical industry to price a loan at the benchmark rate of SOFR plus 5.5%. In first quarter 2026, that percentage skyrocketed to 33%. We are seeing a trickle-down tightening effect. While small businesses don't typically borrow directly from massive private credit funds, they are highly sensitive to the impact, said Aditya Narula, Senior Vice President and General Manager of Lending and Credit at Bluevine, in an email. Since private credit markets act as the wholesale provider of capital for the broader lending industry, any increase in their cost of capital is passed directly down to small business borrowers. David Johnson, CEO of Vervent, a global financial services firm, said in an email that when the private market starts having issues, lenders reprice risk and protect their liquidity, which leads to tighter underwriting, longer decision times, and higher capital costs. Johnson described the current environment as open but more selective and less forgiving. He added that companies with strong financial reporting and resilient cash flow will still have access to capital. Private credit matters because even when it's not the direct lender to Main Street, it still influences liquidity, pricing, and risk appetite across the broader lending ecosystem, Johnson said. New SBA initiatives in play. The challenges with private credit come at a time when the Small Business Administration has pushed a series of programs designed to bolster companies in targeted industries. The agency recently said small manufacturers soon will be eligible for enhanced support through the SBA's International Trade Loan Program. Loans through that program come with a 90% guarantee compared to a 75% guarantee for loans made through the SBA's primary 7A lending program. Starting May 1, manufacturers across NAICS sectors 31 through 33 will become eligible for the expanded ITL program. The new initiative follows the SBA's decision last year to allow food-related businesses into the ITL program for the same enhanced federal guarantees. That expansion applies to small businesses engaged in select farming sectors, as well as ranching and meat production, alongside packaging and machinery manufacturers. Early last year, the SBA finalized a rule designed to speed up the Small Business Investment Company program, in which the agency issues licenses and guarantees to private investment firms to invest in small businesses. The SBIC reached a record $53 billion in combined private capital and SBA leverage in fiscal 2025, compared to $46 billion in fiscal 2024. The SBA also approved a record 86 SBIC licenses on a conditional basis. The SBA last year also rolled out the 7A Manufacturers Access to Revolving Credit, or MARC, loan program to offer working capital for small businesses engaged in manufacturing that the agency said would provide maximum flexibility and minimal red tape. The MARC loan limit is $5 million, with the SBA guaranteeing 85% of loans up to $150,000 and 75% for loans above that up to the maximum. Another new SBA initiative heading into 2026 was the waiving of most loan fees for small manufacturers. That means for 7A loans of up to $950,000, the upfront fee now is 0%. For all 504 manufacturing loans, the upfront fee and annual service fee are 0%. These new reduced fees went into effect on October 1 and run through September 30. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. This is written by Dane Huffman. Owner of Raleigh Gas Station expands. Glenwood Village's Barker acquires new station on Strickland Road. The owner of a Raleigh service station with a unique connection to the city has expanded to a second location. Brian Barker's family has been in the service station business for decades. His grandfather, Bill, owned a station across from Cary High School, where the young Brian learned the business. I used to pump gas for Jim Valvano there, Barker said of the former NC State University basketball coach who lived in McGregor Downs. Mike Barker, Brian's father, later owned an Exxon station at Crossroads in Cary. Now the focus is on Raleigh. Mike Barker owns the North Hills Exxon, and Brian Barker owns Glenwood Village Tire Pros, while his sister, Kendra Self, does all the books. The Glenwood location was once owned by Avery Upchurch, Raleigh's mayor, from 1983 to 1993. The affable Upchurch pumped gas for Raleigh's cars, but also provided fuel for the growth that took off in the 1980s. The Barkers eventually bought the station, with Brian Barker paying his father $1.4 million for it. That location, with three bays and six pumps, generates $7 million in annual revenue and $2.2 million from the bays, thanks to a loyal customer base. That's a saving grace for that place. People feel like they have an ownership in it, he said. They want it to succeed. With his father, now 69, and the North Hill station facing demolition ahead, Barker, 48, expanded. He paid $538,000 for the 5-bay, 12-pump station at 9501 Strickland Road, where the bays do $1 million a year. Barker credits his 9 employees at each location as being essential, as well as a strong relationship with Sampson Blade and Oil Company. And just like his grandfather and father and Mayor Upchurch, keeping a check on customers drives success. I'm shaking hands and kissing babies, Barker said. Triangle Golf Courses, part of larger sale. The parent company of 4 Triangle Golf Courses is set to be bought by a private equity firm, according to a Reuters report. KSL Capital Partners has agreed to purchase Invited Clubs, a Texas operator of golf and membership clubs, for roughly $3 billion, including debt, according to Reuters. Invited's portfolio of more than 150 clubs includes Briar Creek Country Club in Raleigh, Devil's Ridge Golf Club in Holly Springs, Lockmere Golf Club in Cary, and the Hassan Tree Club in Wake Forest. KSL says it is a global leader in travel and leisure investments. Dairy O looks to break into the Sanford market. A Winston-Salem restaurant chain is looking to expand to Sanford as the growing city continues to attract retailers. Dairy O, and that's spelled D-A-I-R-I-O, purchased a vacant 1.78-acre parcel between U.S. 1 and Marketplace Drive for $2 million recently, according to Lee County deed records. The site sits next to a CVS pharmacy, and a 300-unit apartment complex is being built by Dominion Realty Partners nearby as well. The restaurant chain submitted plans to the Sanford-Lee County Broadway Technical Review Committee in January. Triangle TV station, one of FCC's targets. ABC 11, a Triangle television station whose parent is the Walt Disney Company, is one of the stations facing a serious review by the federal government, with its broadcast license at stake. The Federal Communications Commission, in a decision announced April 28, said it is reviewing 8 stations owned and operated by Disney, which owns the American Broadcasting Corporation, or ABC. The federal government requires stations to have licenses, which the government reviews. The FCC has enormous power over local broadcasters who get the lucrative broadcasting licenses for free, but revoking a license is extremely rare. A Disney spokesperson said the company's record demonstrates our continued qualifications as licensees. And finally, ECU slashes programs as part of budget cuts. North Carolina's university system has faced some chops recently, and now East Carolina University is discontinuing dozens of academic programs and consolidating several education units as it cuts $25 million from its budget over 3 years. ECU evaluated 107 programs across 8 colleges and identified 44 programs for discontinuation. The cuts come as universities nationwide grapple with long-term demographic shifts and declines in traditional college-age students. At ECU, the programs being slashed include a mix of certificates, minors, and bachelor's and master's degrees across multiple colleges. This includes academic areas such as health sciences, education, social sciences, technology, and interdisciplinary studies. And now we turn to the top news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. Actually, we have one in this edition, written by Zach Ezone. Struggling St. Augs files Chapter 11 petition. Raleigh school that dates to 1867 faces enormous financial hurdles. St. Augustine's University in Raleigh has filed for bankruptcy protection after years of financial turmoil and will soon lose accreditation. The petition for Chapter 11 reorganization was filed April 27 and comes after the historically black school has been unable to maintain its financial standing amid repeated legal battles over its accreditation. St. Augustine's has accumulated tens of millions in debt, including unpaid taxes and vendor claims. In its bankruptcy filing, the university estimated its assets at between $100 million and $500 million, and its liabilities at between $50 million and $100 million. The school also listed its number of estimated creditors at more than 200. St. Augustine's opened in 1867, but enrollment has fallen to under 200 students. In a press release, the school said the bankruptcy is part of strategic actions to strengthen its financial foundation, address accreditation matters, and position the institution for long-term success, adding the university will continue to operate. Government agencies account for many of St. Augustine's largest unsecured creditors, according to the filing. The Internal Revenue Service is listed as the largest creditor with a claim of about $14.4 million, followed by the U.S. Department of Commerce at about $2.1 million. St. Augustine's filed its voluntary petition for bankruptcy in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. In 2024, a Durham investment group called Gothic Ventures provided St. Augustine's with $7 million in financing with the potential for up to $30 million in total. The university put up its real estate, which is assessed at more than $100 million, to secure the loan. According to Wake County Property Records, Self-Help Ventures Fund, a nonprofit affiliate of Self-Help Credit Union in Durham, assumed a $7 million promissory note along with the associated mortgage and collateral in December from two Gothic-related entities. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter pages. First, we come to Ben Tobin's page, Greater Triangle. First headline, Data Center Fight Escalates. Developer files lawsuit opposing Chatham County moratorium. The developer planning a large-scale data center in Chatham County is suing the county over its newly enacted moratorium, alleging officials ignored existing approvals and violated state law to halt the project. Echo Tip West LLC, a group for which Kirk Bradley, president and CEO of Lemoore Capital, is a manager, filed the lawsuit in Chatham County Superior Court on April 23. In the lawsuit, Echo Tip West said that the moratorium has and continues to cause Echo Tip substantial financial and other losses. The Chatham County Board of Commissioners voted in early February to enact a 12-month moratorium on permitting of data centers, data processing facilities, cryptocurrency mining operations, and any other associated uses within the unincorporated areas of Chatham County. County representatives did not respond to requests seeking comment about the lawsuit. Smith Anderson is representing EchoTip West in the lawsuit. Partner Mitch Armbruster declined to comment beyond the complaint. In the lawsuit, EchoTip West claims it has spent years of time, effort, and over $11 million to develop an approximately 750-megawatt data center at Tip West, a more than 400-acre heavy industrial site that's part of the Triangle Innovation Point megasite in Moncure. The data center project is currently a use permitted by right under the Chatham County zoning ordinance in the heavy industrial district, the lawsuit reads. This means there are no additional approvals required to develop and operate that use. The lawsuit claims county officials confirmed that status in 2025 and issued a zoning permit. EchoTip West alleges that at some point thereafter, but before January 20, county officials met behind closed doors with data center opponents and decided to stop all development of data centers in the county for at least 1 year, and that the moratorium was unjustifiably rushed. In Wilson County, long vacant restaurant space sells. A former restaurant space in Wilson has sold for the second time in less than 3 years. Sawpack Capital, an LLC that lists the address of Raleigh developer Stronic Properties, purchased the former Texas Steakhouse and Saloon at 2901 Raleigh Road Parkway West in Wilson for $2.4 million, according to Wilson County deed records and NC Secretary of State filings. The 5,950-square-foot building sits on 1.8 acres. Stronic Properties deals in build-to-suit projects with a focus on single-tenant spaces for national retailers, according to its website. In May 2023, an LLC tied to Tidal Wave Auto Spa, which operates a chain of car washes with locations across the Southeast and now the Midwest, purchased the Wilson property for $2.2 million. The recent sale shows redevelopment potential for commercial properties in Wilson as investors look for opportunities in established retail corridors. Sites along Raleigh Road Parkway have seen renewed interest in recent years, with buyers targeting vacant or underutilized properties as the city works to attract new businesses and reinvestment. Wilson, a former tobacco hub, has struggled in recent decades with population decline, but with renewed public-private investment, the city and county are turning things around in terms of commercial projects. And finally, in Person County, Frito-Lay Distribution Center sold for $1.4 million. A relatively new Frito-Lay Distribution Center in rural North Carolina has traded hands, underscoring growing investor appetite for small-scale logistics assets outside major metros. Lucy Garrett Rode, a Wake Forest-based LLC, bought the 3,500-square-foot facility at 101 Lucy Garrett Road in Roxborough for just shy of $1.4 million recently, according to Person County deed records. The property sits on 2.36 acres. Lucy Garrett Road LLC lists Wayne Timberlake as a member, according to NC Secretary of State filings. He did not respond to a request seeking comment on the purchase. The seller is DevReco, an LLC that lists the address of Gillis Gilkerson, a construction and development firm located in Salisbury, Maryland. The LLC purchased the then vacant land in 2021 for $150,000. The recent deal reflects a broader trend of investors targeting smaller industrial assets in rural markets where lower acquisition costs and steady tenant demand tied to logistics and distribution can offer attractive returns. According to a press release from November 2022, Gillis Gilkerson partnered with local contractor Chadco Builders to build the Roxborough Frito-Lay Distribution Center as well as one in the Burlington area. Formed in 1961 and headquartered in Plano, Texas, Frito-Lay is behind some of the most well-known snack brands in the United States. These include Fritos, Cheetos, Doritos, Tostitos, Lay's, Ruffles, and Rolled Gold Pretzels. The company is a subsidiary of PepsiCo. And now we turn to the technology and innovation page. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. First Citizens drops SVB name with rebrand. Raleigh Bank acquired Silicon Valley Bank back in 2023. First Citizens Bank is officially doing what the market has already done, moving on from the Silicon Valley Bank name. More than 3 years after Raleigh-based First Citizens acquired SVB from regulators following the third largest bank failure in U.S. history, the Silicon Valley Bank brand is being retired. Later this year, most of SVB's operations will be rebranded as First Citizens Innovation Banking and First Citizens Fund Banking. SVB has operated within First Citizens' corporate umbrella since the March 2023 acquisition. Executives say the timing of the rebrand reflects how much the combined bank and First Citizens' own profile has changed since the crisis. The why now is a function of where we've gotten to in the past 3 years, said Mark Cadeau, president of SVB under First Citizens. When First Citizens stepped in to acquire SVB after its collapse, executives acknowledged they were inheriting a customer base deeply loyal to the SVB brand and often unfamiliar with First Citizens. We were concerned about client acceptance, said Peter Bristow, president at First Citizens. We were concerned about SVB associate acceptance. 3 years in, we feel really good about that. Entrepreneurs and investors told Triangle Business Journal the SVB brand has diminished since the 2023 collapse. I haven't heard of anyone using SVB in years, said Scott Wingo, founder of seed investor NC Tweener Fund. I don't see SVB much out there today, said Lister Delgado of Investor Idea Fund Partners. Delgado said there are still some companies in his firm's portfolio that bank with SVB. Cadeau and the First Citizens leaders say assumptions that the bank is too conservative for early-stage startups miss how the institution thinks about risk and opportunity. Much like SVB was, we're not afraid of risk, so as long as it's well understood, we're confident we can manage it well, and there's differentiated value to be had in taking that risk, Cadeau said. The branding change is scheduled to take effect in the fourth quarter. And there's also a big number with this article, 17, the number of Silicon Valley Bank branches that became part of First Citizens. Local firms seek refunds after ruling by the court. Businesses are moving forward with claims for tariff refunds, despite President Donald Trump warning companies he will remember those that ask for their money back. The federal government faces the prospect of repaying billions of dollars in duties after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down some tariffs on February 20th. Businesses collectively paid an estimated $166 billion in tariffs that are now eligible for refunds, but experts have warned the process could be complex, particularly for smaller firms. Executives told Triangle Business Journal they expect refunds to arrive within 60 to 90 days, though the scale of the repayments has raised questions about timing and logistics. Trump has urged companies to forego refunds altogether, but executives in North Carolina say they are pressing ahead. Art Pope, CEO of Variety Wholesalers, parent of retail chains Roses and Big Lots, said the Henderson-based company filed its refund claims April 20. And Captive Air, a manufacturer of commercial kitchen ventilation systems based in Raleigh, also applied for refunds, according to CEO Bob Luddy. Other business leaders declined to comment publicly on their refund plan, citing Trump's statements or concerns about the optics of pursuing repayments after raising prices to offset the tariffs. And finally, in Mooresville, Forge Nano insists 200-job gigafactory still in its plans. When Forge Nano unveiled plans in 2023 to create 200 jobs at a lithium-ion battery gigafactory in Mooresville, the timeline was ambitious but clear. The factory would be online in 2026. 3 years later, the plant has yet to materialize. The company's local workforce remains under 20 employees, raising questions about whether the facility will ultimately happen. But Forge Nano CEO Bob Lichty said the project is still very much alive. Speaking from New York, where the Colorado-based firm recently announced plans to go public, Lichty said Forge Nano now expects the factory to be operational within 2 years. By early 2028, we should be up and operating, he told Triangle Business Journal. Lichty said the company, whose technology was recently deployed in satellites launched by SpaceX, intends to follow through on its Mooresville commitment, and the pending IPO shapes the path forward. Forge Nano's careers page still lists only projected roles for the Triangle region. Lichty said hiring will ramp up as the company approaches commissioning. And now we turn to Kaylee Thompson's page. This is on real estate and development. Luxury tower scores $105 million loan. Mave is one of many new apartment offerings in downtown Raleigh. And Mave is spelled M-A-E-V-E. Downtown Raleigh's newest residential tower has been refinanced with a $105 million loan amid an oversupply of new apartment units across the city. Virginia-based Capital Square secured the floating-rate, interest-only bridge loan with TPG Real Estate Finance for Mave, a 297-unit luxury apartment building that rises 20 stories and overlooks Red Hat Amphitheater. The loan replaces an $80 million construction loan from First National Bank and will help Capital Square reduce its cost of capital while the property stabilizes, said Natalie Mason, Executive Vice President and co-head of development for Capital Square. Construction costs of the tower were about $110 million. The property at 319 West Lenore Street is now assessed at $109.8 million. Mave opened a year ago and is more than 50% leased. Mason estimates the building will reach a stabilization rate of 95% in early 2027. Mave lies in an opportunity zone, one reason why Capital Square acquired the site and developed the residential tower. However, the refinancing does not affect that status or the equity associated with the opportunity zone. Mason said the company started the process of looking for a lender for refinancing in the fall and had dozens of lenders interested. Everyone is attracted to this market. We have some short-term headwinds with a lot of the new supply in the market, but all the fundamentals for multifamily investment are still great in this region, so it definitely attracted a lot of lender interest just because of the market itself, Mason said. Thousands of multifamily units have delivered in recent years, with more in the pipeline, resulting in an oversupply that has kept rents relatively flat. For downtown Raleigh, thousands of units came online with Mave, 400H, The Weld, and Rockaway Raleigh, all opening in the past year. Kane plans eight-story apartment at Midline. The expansion of the North Hills Innovation District continues as Kane Realty Corporation has mapped out the first building on the Midline Raleigh site after acquiring the property for $72 million early this year. The real estate company is planning an eight-story mixed-use building along Navajo Drive, per site plan submitted to the city. It will be the first building on the company's recently acquired 28-acre property that extends the Innovation District further east along Interstate 440. A spokesperson for Kane Realty said the apartments will be an age-restricted community for residents 55 and older. Site plans show the development will be on lots 2 and 3 of the 901 Navajo Drive site. Kane submitted a subdivision plan in December to divide the property into 16 lots. Lot 3 will have the 8-story building with 207 units and 17,000 square feet of retail space. Lot 3 will be between Quail Hollow Drive and the future extension of Oakline Drive. The lot is 1.87 acres and now holds five-story garden apartment buildings, holds five two-story garden apartment buildings and one single-story laundry building, part of the Point at Midtown apartment complex, which will be demolished to make way for the new project. The units will be split into 124 one-bedroom and 83 two-bedroom apartments. Minnesota developer adds affordable housing options. Oppidan Investment Company, and that's spelled O-P-P-I-D-A-N, of Minnesota, has added 299 units to the affordable housing stock with two new communities in East and South Raleigh. The communities are the firm's first foray into affordable housing. Noah Wagner, Vice President of Development, said Oppidan, chose Raleigh because of the strong public-private partnerships and the state's bond capacity for affordable housing. There's a lot of communities where they talk about affordable housing, but they don't have a lot of tools to make it happen. But what we're seeing, the city of Raleigh is trying to get creative and make these projects happen however they can, which has been really great to have as a partner, Wagner said. The Pines at Peach in South Raleigh opened its final building at the end of 2025 and is more than 90% leased. In East Raleigh, Birch and Branch opened for leasing in January and has enough applications approved to fill 75% of the units. And finally, apartments planned for New Bern Avenue. A custom home builder is taking advantage of higher density zoning along New Bern Avenue as part of the bus rapid transit corridor in Raleigh. Adient Development LLC, that's spelled A-D-I-A-N-T, managed by Mike Poupard, co-founder of Grayson Homes, filed site plans with the City of Raleigh for a mixed-use building downtown. The plan calls for 91 apartments and retail space on a one-acre site near the Explorers School Elementary campus. Site plans show there will be 25 one-bedroom units and 66 two-bedroom units in a five-story building with four retail spaces. The retail space will be at the corner of New Bern Avenue and South Swain Street. The 225,750-square-foot mixed-use building will be on 0.96 acres at 16.5 and 18 South Swain Street and 574 New Bern Avenue. And our final reporter page covers healthcare and life sciences. This is written by Zach Ezone. AbbVie plans to create a new campus in Durham. Global life sciences firm to invest $1.4 billion in manufacturing plant. A global life sciences company is planning a billion-dollar investment in the Triangle. AbbVie plans to invest $1.4 billion in a new 185-acre manufacturing campus in Durham County that is expected to create 734 jobs. The state's Economic Investment Committee, part of the NC Department of Commerce, approved an incentives package supporting the project during a meeting April 22. The project was approved for a job development investment grant worth up to $25.8 million, plus approximately $25 million in local incentives from the city of Durham and the county. The campus near Research Triangle Park will support AbbVie's drug production in the areas of immunology, oncology, and neuroscience. The company selected Durham for the facility over the Chicago area, officials said. AbbVie in February announced a significant expansion in North Chicago, where the company is based. The campus is part of AbbVie's plans to invest $100 billion in the U.S. over the next decade. The company selected Durham because of the regional workforce and its ability to support future expansion, AbbVie said in a statement. Our investment in North Carolina represents a significant milestone for AbbVie as our largest capital investment to date and an important expansion of our manufacturing footprint into a new region of the United States, said CEO Robert Michael. AbbVie plans to begin construction this year and complete the first phase in 2028. This first phase will include small-volume parenteral drug product manufacturing facilities, laboratories, a warehouse, administrative offices, and employee wellness facilities. The company expects to bring on 734 employees over the next 4 years, including engineers, scientists, manufacturing operators, and laboratory technicians. These jobs will pay a minimum average wage of $118,041, according to Commerce officials. AbbVie, a $61 billion revenue company, is the latest drug maker to make major commitments to North Carolina. Last year, the state landed 18 major life sciences projects, totaling about $3.8 billion worth of investments, mostly in the Triangle. UNC Health looks to expand in western North Carolina. UNC Health is proposing a $23 million facility in the Carolina foothills as it pushes to expand across North Carolina. UNC has filed a Certificate of Need application with the NC Department of Health and Human Services, seeking approval for a freestanding hybrid emergency department and urgent care facility in the Caldwell County town of Granite Falls, north of Hickory. The proposal comes after UNC fell short in a much larger expansion effort in western North Carolina. DHHS recently denied the health system's proposal to develop a 129-bed, $711 million hospital in the Asheville area. Instead, the state regulator approved competing proposals from Mission Health and Novant Health. UNC operates in Caldwell County as UNC Health Caldwell, which formed from Caldwell Memorial Hospital joining UNC in 2013. In addition to the hospital, UNC Health Caldwell operates outpatient and specialty care sites across the county, including urgent care clinics, an ambulatory surgery center, and medical office campuses such as Rivercrest Medical Park. UNC proposes building a 14,400-square-foot facility in southern Caldwell that would also serve patients in neighboring Catawba and Burke counties. The total projected capital expenditure is $22.86 million. And the final story, Duke-UNC battle for new hospital beds in Durham. While they team up on a multi-billion dollar children's hospital in Apex, Duke Health and UNC Health continue to compete for hospital expansions in Durham County. Duke is seeking approval to add 135 acute care beds at its flagship hospital campus in Durham and 22 beds at Duke Regional Hospital in North Durham. Meanwhile, UNC is pursuing 42 additional beds for its planned hospital campus in southern Durham County, a project already approved for 102 beds. The health systems last month filed the applications with the NC Department of Health and Human Services in response to the 2026 State Medical Facilities Plan, which identified a need for 236 additional acute care beds in Durham County. Duke's proposals include estimated capital expenditures of $40 million for the Duke University Hospital expansion and $23 million to add beds at Duke Regional Hospital. UNC's proposed expansion has an estimated capital expenditure of $18.7 million. This would raise the approved capital cost of the future UNC Hospital's campus, Cary campus, located off Highway 55 in South Durham, to $1 billion, according to the application. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice Q&A column. This one is on Derek Willard. In a closer look, title, Head of School, Ravenscroft, age 57, education, BS, biology, Davidson College, master's in education, educational leadership, Winthrop University, family, wife Jenny, son Mac, daughter Anna Grace, first job, in high school, worked as a farm laborer harvesting watermelons in Scotland County. Before becoming an educator, Derek Willard was a leader in the U.S. Army, serving in roles such as platoon leader and a tank battalion supply officer. He now leans on some of the principles he learned there in his current role as head of one of the largest private schools in the Triangle. Now in his second year as head of school at Ravenscroft, Willard leads the school of about 1,250 students and roughly 340 employees with an eye toward the future, and with a sprawling 135-acre campus in Raleigh, there's room to grow, he said. How long have you been in your current role? This is my second year as head of school at Ravenscroft. Prior to that, I was head of school at Augusta Preparatory Day School in Augusta, Georgia, for 5 years. I was drawn to Ravenscroft for several reasons. First, I knew it was a great school with a national reputation and one of the oldest in the state, its roots going all the way back to 1862. Second, I was inspired by the mission to nurture individual potential and prepare students to thrive in a complex and interdependent world. Third, I was intrigued that the nurture and prepare was accomplished in part through the school's signature Lead From Here leadership curriculum, which was developed through an innovative partnership with the Center for Creative Leadership. Finally, once I interviewed, I found an extremely welcoming community and a very talented team. How has your experience prepared you for this role? Well, before I became an educator, I started my professional journey as a U.S. Army Combat Arms Officer. My final assignment in the Army was Tank Battalion Supply Officer, and that role really prepared me to understand the logistic planning necessary to sustain a large organization. Those 4 years taught me so many transferable skills that I use as an educational leader today. Ravenscroft's enrollment has remained fairly consistent in recent years. How does the school view its enrollment needs looking ahead? Our enrollment has indeed been steady at 1,250 pre-K to 12 students and is now actually inching upward. We have seen record inquiries and applications over the last few years. A recent market study informed us that the number of school-aged children in Raleigh is expected to remain relatively flat in the future, so we will have to work very hard to convince more local families to invest in their children's education if we want to keep growing. Have vouchers affected your school? Ravenscroft does not accept vouchers because we value our independence, and Ravenscroft has always maintained a robust financial aid budget, so we encourage families interested to go through that process to investigate potential awards. What are your goals for Ravenscroft? In the short term, I want to make sure we work hard to provide the very best student experience possible across academics, arts, and athletics. I have pushed our leaders and educators to help students start to develop proficiency with artificial intelligence tools in an ethical and safe manner. I'm really proud of our team for leading in this space. And as for the long term, we are currently finalizing a strategic vision, and we hope to share those priorities with our community next fall. Stay tuned. What's the greatest need at your school? More square footage. What's your best advice for students? I give our high school students this advice, the four T's, every fall. Treat each other well. Think before you act. Try new things. And thank your parents. What books are on your nightstand? I just finished Brunelleschi's Dome, How a Renaissance Genius Reinvented Architecture by Ross King. I started The Infinite Game by Simon Sinek. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Project Life series, Executive Health and Worker Wellness in the Triangle. And this article is part of a series written by Connie Gentry. Care and Connection for Veterans. Wake County leaders are focusing on prevention and support to reduce veteran suicide risk by creating time, distance, and connection during moments of crisis. Weighing heavily on hearts and minds has been the likelihood that U.S. service members are facing heightened danger given the war in Iran and overall geopolitical uncertainties. But a greater threat to the safety of our armed forces may be their personal struggles during and after military service. Since the post-9/11 era began in 2001, more than 5,600 U.S. service members have died from hostile action, according to the Department of Defense. In that same time frame, over 7,300 service members have died from self-inflicted injury during military service. Additionally, more than 140,000 veterans have died by suicide after transitioning into civilian life, according to the national nonprofit Stop Soldier Suicide. Suicidality is a reality that Siobhan Norris has confronted in her professional role as Director of Veteran Services for Wake County, as well as in her personal life, where she worked to unpack the baggage from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in her own years of service in the U.S. Army Military Police Corps. Working alongside Stop Soldier Suicide, which is headquartered in the Triangle, Norris led Wake County in initiating Lock, Call, Live, a public awareness campaign driven by the SAFE, Suicide Awareness and Firearm Education Coalition. The intention is to reduce suicide by those who have served in the armed forces, and specifically to do this by reducing suicide through lethal means, meaning any attempt related to firearms, Norris said. This campaign has been done with a very thoughtful approach and the understanding that the Second Amendment, gun rights, are a very sensitive topic to a lot of folks in the U.S., especially those who served. The initiative has included key partnerships to promote safe behavior in times of crisis, including with support organizations like Veterans Bridge Home and the Joel Fund, as well as members of the firearms industry, such as the Triangle Shooting Academy. It led Norris to investigate what the suicide landscape looks like in Wake County. So working with the Register of Deeds, we pulled death certificates from 2020 to 2024, she said. What she discovered is that veterans disproportionately accounted for suicide deaths, representing 13% of the 570 suicides during that five-year span, even though veterans make up only about 4% of the county's population. It mirrors the national trend where Stop Soldier Suicide has found that veterans have a 58% higher risk of suicide than their civilian counterparts, and firearms are known to be the leading method of death by suicide among veterans, accounting for 64% of veteran suicides in Wake County between 2020 and 2023. The best practice that we've seen for suicide prevention is time and distance. The more time and more distance you can put between somebody in crisis and their firearm, the more likely that their chances of dying by suicide decrease, Norris said. Using a gun lock, whether it's one of the little red plastic locks that are really hard to take off or having a safe that requires you to put in a significant code, If you can lock up that firearm, put as much distance and time between you and that firearm when you're in a crisis, and then call somebody that you trust, a battle buddy, a clergy member, the VA suicide hotline, you're more likely to live, and that's how we came up with Lock, Call, Live. The campaign launched in 2024 with a powerful spokesperson and suicide survivor, Michael Remar, who attempted to take his own life with a firearm. We wanted to address the elephant in the room, which with suicide prevention is firearms, because they are such a big part of the veteran community and their identity, said John Richardson, Vice President of Research and Evaluation at Stop Soldier Suicide. We wanted someone with life experience who had attempted suicide with a firearm and could say what they wish everyone else knew if they were considering suicide by firearm. Working with NAMI Wake County, the local chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Norris and Richardson connected with Reimar, who was participating in NAMI's Suicide Survivor Group. In video and public service announcements, Reimar shares his story, acknowledging he doesn't remember all the feelings that preceded his decision to pull the trigger, but he does recall feeling regret and remorse almost as soon as he attempted suicide. If the gun had been locked away, if he'd made a call, he thinks it would have stopped him from attempting suicide. Michael's courage in talking about his journey and the things he wishes other people would know, that's what has made this campaign so powerful, Richardson said. Although Reimar is not a veteran, his candor and first-person account resonate across communities, and Lock, Call, Live can benefit anyone with suicidal ideation. Michael really is a source of encouragement, and his bravery in sharing his story has inspired me to open up about my personal experiences, said Norris, whose service from 2000 to 2004 included a 2-year deployment to South Korea, where she was the victim of military sexual trauma. And we're going to skip ahead a little in the article to mention the VA's national screening program reveals 1 in 3 women experience MST during their service, and military sexual trauma often contributes to thoughts of suicide. And also in another section, free mental health counseling is available at Stop Soldier Suicide, and Richardson, who served in the North Carolina Army National Guard, encourages businesses to share their website, goroger.org, with veteran employee resource groups. Today's program is underwritten by Highwoods Properties, with its headquarters in Raleigh, North Carolina. Highwoods, a real estate investment trust, is committed to making our communities better places to live and work. Highwoods can be reached at 866-449-6637. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. Again, I'm Derek Frost, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.